Something will always go wrong. It always does. That's okay. But if you have the meat, the core, everything right, then you just move forward. You take over that facility, and then you can move to optimizing it, growing it, and making a great business out of it. Take our list, use our steps, and that will guide you, and you'll know everything you need to know.
100%. Go get yourself a facility, guys.
What's up, everybody, and welcome to Self Storage Income. We are on the backs of an episode that we made, which was the Beginner's Guide to Finding Self-Storage Deals in Any Market, and it was a step-by-step guide. Today, we're moving on to How to Buy Your First Storage Facility, a step-by-step guide.
It's going to be awesome, man. If you guys haven't listened to that previous episode, go back, listen about, you know, how AJ started back in the day, figuring out where deals were, how to analyze those things, really just getting in, like finding the deal in the first place, right? Just having a step-by-step process to find a deal to in your area that meets the buy boxes and all the things that we talked about in that episode. It was really, really good. So go back, listen to that. Now, obviously, another huge key piece. We got to buy the things, man.
That's right. A lot of these things are interchangeable, and this is something we really need to look at. The interchangeable things that we look at are finding deals, doing deals, operating deals. And what I mean by that is there's all this overlap, okay? So things aren't necessarily totally isolated. I mean, when you're finding a deal, that is going to depend on your operating of the deal because you're buying, finding deals that you will operate in a certain way. Okay. What we want to take out and look at this time is we are trying to simplify this and not get too complicated in it. So it is a step-by-step. So please refer to the last one that talks about how to find them. We're not going to rehash that. Now, in this one, we're going to talk about the actual buying of the deal. That means we are under the realm of you've found one, right? So the assumptions we would be making is you found one that meets your buy box, which we explain, both buy box on your facility, but also market. So that then aligns with your operations and what you want to do with it, okay? Now, the reason why this is important, because this does come down to things like price and underwriting. We are going under the assumptions that this is a value add facility. That means, and for this case, we will use more of a smaller market, maybe a smaller facility that is value add, but it is regardless, the steps to buy is regardless of market size, anything else. Just creating the conditions here for the explanation so we don't get too lost in it. And I will use these conditions and in the explanation so we can talk about things simply. All of them, though, are used. All these steps are, once again, regardless of price, market, size of the asset, or strategy. Okay. If we get too caught up in all sorts of other things, we'll miss the step-by-step and we're going to miss the whole meat.
Well, and it's subjective anyways.
Exactly.
Once you get that granular.
Exactly. So it's like these things you will do on every single one. Okay. Now, to actually buy your first facility, we have a two formats I'll use. That's an off-market deal and an on-market deal. And all that means is off-market deal is by yourself and an on-market deal is with a broker. I understand you can get off-market deals from brokers, but for the purpose of this explanation, the off-market deal is no broker. The on-market deal is with a broker. Two very distinct things, okay? Now, buying the facility, you found a facility that you want to buy. I've been going back and forth, but we're going to start with an off-market deal because that leads to you actually have to get the owner to sell and you have to negotiate that way. Whereas if you're dealing with a broker, the owner is ready to sell. The broker's done all this work. They're presenting an opportunity for you in which you will decide, and then we'll take it from there. So if we're doing an off-market deal, we need to start before you get to that point. in order to start for that, we do have a few more steps in our step-by-step. The first thing is, if you guys have not heard our process on how to get to an owner to sell, we actually have a step-by-step process, which you can go through. But we're going to start at the negotiation of a price, okay? The step-by-step on getting an owner to sell, just briefly, so we have those conditions correct. We talk about my idea of I want them to ask me to buy their facility, meaning that I'm not going around to owners and just saying, can I buy your facility? You're building a relationship with them, right? You're under the conditions in which you can present that opportunity and have a discussion about it. This discussion then leads us to the price point. And that's where we're going to start off, as in we're starting off with the offer, okay? The offer to purchase that facility, which once again is different than buying. This is the first step in buying, okay? The offer to purchase it should be predicated on what you are willing to pay for that asset, which will be defined in a few things. We'll talk about its intrinsic, extrinsic value. Now, all of you that have listened to intrinsic is simply what it produces today. So I buy it for $1 million and it makes $100,000. The value isn't the $1 million that I paid for it. The value is, the intrinsic value is the $100,000 that I get from it, regardless of what I pay for it. The extrinsic value is the price of the thing in which I bought. That would be the $1 million. That's it. So extrinsic value, everybody, is made up of marketplaces between buyers and sellers of the asset. Intrinsic value is made up of the asset and what it produces. That's the main difference between intrinsic and extrinsic value. When you are doing it, you are concerned with the intrinsic value and how the market price affects the intrinsic value to you. In storage, all commercial real estate, we use cap rates. Cap rates are an expression of value due to the return that you will get. Let me make this very simple. If I bought something for $1 million and it made $100,000, that's a 10 cap. Why? Because it makes a 10% return off that $1 million. If it made $50,000, that would be a 5 cap, a 5% return off the $1 million. That's what a cap rate means, simply defined as that. It does not include debt. So debt always changes and is different from independent parties, and you don't look at it with debt. That's your own problem, okay? So if you bought something for a 5 cap and it made $50,000, but then after debt, you didn't make anything and it was negative cash flow, that doesn't mean it's not a 5 cap, right? So very important that we look and determine these things. Now, with those conditions set into place, the offer that you should generate, you will look at how much cash it makes to you, the intrinsic value, what it takes for you to make that cash. Okay. That's not just expenses, but that's also capital expenses, right? So you may need to, in order to maintain that cash flow, you may need to fix things. There may be things broken. So that needs to be included because you're getting that $100,000. And in order to keep getting it, you have to do certain things to the site. Those capital expenditures are different than I'm doing an expansion or I want to put a gate that didn't exist in. Why? Because you're already making the $100,000. So those are add-ons or improvements. Very different. Add-ons and improvements don't include what the cash flow that is making that you're buying. So when we look at deals that we're buying, I say, I'm getting $100,000 for my $1 million. What are the things that have to be done to make sure it keeps getting it? Perfect example is this, is the gate is broken. Okay, well, but the people that are in there buy and pay with the expectation of a gate working because that's what they're paying for. That would be something that is a capital expenditure that has to be working in order to keep making the $100,000. Mm-hmm. If there wasn't a gate in there, there never has been a gate in there and people are paying and I'm making $100,000 and the gate was never part of the equation, but I want to put a gate in, that is an addition to it, right? That's not getting rid of it. So I couldn't say to the owner, well, you need to come $30,000 off because I have to put a gate in. The owner's like, why? That has nothing to do with the money I'm making. It never has been. We're a facility without a gate. Very, very different things. So when I'm looking at the intrinsic value, I make $100,000. Is there things in this facility that have to be done that's going to require capital to continue making it? I have to put that into the price. Now, aside from that, the price that I want to offer should be contingent on the return I want to make. if I'm saying I want to make a 25% return or a 50% return, I'm going to say, well, I want to pay you $200,000 to make $100,000 a year because I want to make a 50% cash on cash return every single year. And the owner is going to laugh at you and tell you never talk to me again because that's insane. Now, you may go, well, dang it, that's really what I wanted. Okay. So you get to offer predicated on what you want. That doesn't mean the owner has to accept it. So, you know, it's, you know, this is the game that you play when you're talking about price. I want to make something from it. Well, so does the owner. So they also have something that they want to make from it. You are trying to find the grounds in which you can meet where you're getting what you want to make or is the minimal acceptable, and the owner is getting what they want to make or the minimal acceptable, and you meet together and it works for both parties. That's what you're doing when you're offering a price. That should be contingent on the return and the value that you're getting. So I look at things and I want to make a 20% internal rate of return over 5 years. I can get that in two different ways. I could buy it and it just cash flows so much we get it, or I can buy it and I can change things to get the cash flow up that will give it to me. One is buying and getting the return existing. The other one's value add. I do value add. That means I can actually buy it and get a lower return that I'm wanting because I can see what I can do to get the return that I'm getting. This is great for the buyer because, or the seller, because then the seller's like, well, I'm getting it for this great price. So for me, if an asset is really maxed out and it's the highest in the market, everything else, that actually I have to pay way less for. Mm-hmm. That's counterintuitive to a lot of people how they think of it. A better asset that's a market leader, better pricing, fully occupied, that should get a higher price. For me, that's not true. Mm-hmm. I would actually pay more for something that was underperforming because what I can do to it will make my returns higher. So when we're talking about price, this is the stuff you're thinking about. But at the end of the day, all you're doing is offering something on that asset that allows you to get whatever return you and your investors want in the simplest format.
Mm-hmm.
I
want to expand on that piece that you just talked about, where, because this kind of ties into that intrinsic, extrinsic value piece that you talked about as well. But that intrinsic value to you, the reason that you can pay more, that you're willing to pay more for a facility that a lot of people wouldn't. Let's say, again, people are looking at something and they're like, oh, yeah, it's a high cap rate. Like, I'd only spend $1 million and then to get the current, you know, cash flow and value that asset's deploying, instead of looking at it and saying, well, the intrinsic value is actually $4 million to me, I'd happily pay $2 million or $3 million or whatever it is for that amount of value because I know I can extract that. So and we have an example of that, of a storage facility in our portfolio that you guys did just that when it was going to an auction and all that stuff. And you guys came out and you bid far and above what everybody else was bidding.
Yes.
And won that facility because you knew the value of that facility to you guys, mm-hmm. and understood it. You weren't just taking it for quote unquote market value.
Yes.
And so that's, I just wanted to touch on that a little bit and expand, because people, I think a lot of times are like, well, why would you pay more for an underperforming facility, like versus a stabilized, you know, value producing facility. So like, that's why. It's just the intrinsic value again to you, if you're willing to pay more than what the market's currently asking for that type of an asset, you can pay more.
Yep, exactly. And this is how we operate and we do things. Now, the one thing that you're going to look at is your ability to pay. So we have the price, which we've talked about is intrinsic. The next side you have is obviously your ability to pay. I'm not going to talk about necessarily the capital you need to put into it, because that can, once again, that's different with every single size market facility, whether you have investors, whether you have money, whether all that kind of stuff. What I mean is the ability to pay for it and it actually work out, because we have to include things like debt, capital expenditures. That is very different. So when cap rates get really low, like a 5 cap, and you are making $50,000 on something you had to pay for $1 million, even if you put half the money down or $500,000 down, interest rates at where they're at today, you won't make money. You'll actually be negative cash flow. So that is why when interest rates rise, normally we see cap rates rise, because your ability to pay for that thing at that cap rate now has changed. Cap rates don't include debt, but you have to. So that's why we see owners want to sell at 5 caps, buyers can't pay for it, and you see markets stall out. So you then need to look at and say, all right, what can I afford to pay? And what is the time frame in which I can get the asset going, all that kind of stuff. You also need to know what you can get for that thing, asset, both in debt and equity. So do investors want it at that level, and will banks buy it at that level? So this comes back down to the extrinsic price, okay? Intrinsic, we figured out, drives our offering for extrinsic. Extrinsic, though, is also being driven by interest rates and what you can afford to pay, investors and banks actually giving the money. So the first step in price, intrinsic, what you want to make, what it's worth to you. Extrinsic, what you can afford, what banks and investors will actually give to you to make that price. Those two things combined get to a point where you can do a deal or a price. It may sound like a lot or confusing. It's actually not. It happens organically. And most people don't even actually know that it's happening when they break it down to intrinsic, extrinsic, or they can't really explain how they got to the price. But that's all that's going on, what I just explained to you. That's it. There may be weird reasons that people buy things. And this is really important. Just because someone else is willing to pay a price doesn't mean that that's what it's worth. This is why I have a problem with people focusing on extrinsic, because extrinsic doesn't mean that's what it's worth. Mm-hmm. Now, somebody may say, but it is, because a marketplace, they're deciding the price. You're right, they're deciding a price, but the value is not the price. Mm-hmm. The value is what it creates or produces. Why that's important? Someone may pay, you may be willing to pay $2 million for the value. Somebody may be paying $3 million, and you're like, maybe I should pay that, only to find out that they paid the $3 million, tore the entire asset down, and built a 10-story condo on there.
Right.
The value to them was different than you, because it was a totally different asset, everything else. Mm-hmm. So you should never think that price equals value, because value is different for different market participators.
Exactly.
Everyone stop confusing those things. This is why we get, and I get really frustrated in the marketplace. Even perfect example is today, it's way harder to get money. Why? Because people are like, oh, well, prices are going down, so that means values are dropping. But no, not at all. If the income is $100,000 and you had to pay $2 million for it a year ago, the income's now still $100,000 and you have to pay $1 million for it, to me, I just got $1 million.
I was going
to
say, it's like the inverse.
The value didn't go down $1 million. Yeah. It went up for me. Yeah. But yet markets don't see that, because they get confused with these two things. So listen to this again. If you're having problems understanding it, I have a whole nother podcast and actual YouTube video on intrinsic and extrinsic. But remember that markets don't look like that. It's so hard to get capital right now, even though people have capital, because they view that it's scary or risky, when actually it's way safer than it was 2 years ago, because you're getting way more for what you're buying. But markets don't think like that. They're emotional, and they don't understand products.
I was going to say, they're driven by people.
They're driven by people. People are emotional, not logical. So when you look at this price, everybody, you remember you are dealing with emotional buyers, sellers, investors, and you need to be cognizant of that. Now, that is how you come up with the price, okay? That can be different with anyone and any individual asset. What you're willing to pay, what your investors are, your banks, everything else, determined by the intrinsic value, which could be different from other people. Meaning that if I bought a 85,000 square foot facility that was a turnaround facility, and somebody else that had no infrastructure, had never done this at all before it, it's going to be worth more to me, because I know how to make it produce more. That doesn't mean they should pay the same price as me. Mm-hmm. So on and so forth. All right, that's price. Step one in buying a facility is price. Now let's go on to the broker side.
When you guys are looking at property management software for your storage facilities, there's a ton of options out there, but no other option compares to Tenant Inc. Tenant Inc. is going to be your one-stop shop solution that has an amazing amount of tools that you can deploy at your fingertips to maximize the value of your facility, to operate it more efficiently, more effectively. They have an open API where you can back in almost anything you want. You own your data, and it's just an incredible solution. I can't say enough good things about these guys. Link is in the show notes. Be sure to check out Tenant Inc.
The broker comes to you and says it's the $5 million. That's what it wants. Now, in order to come up with this price, there's a few things you have to do, okay? Extrinsic value to get the price is you need to know what the owner will sell it for. Simple. Now, whatever they say is not necessarily true because you're going to negotiate. But the second thing you need is you actually need to understand, does it make $100,000? Meaning you need to get rent rolls. You need to get lock checks. You need to understand capital expenditures. So that's where the work comes in to define price for you, is you really have to understand that value that you're buying. Okay. Once you go through and you can get rent rolls, taxes, you can look at the facility, see maybe what the opportunity is, but how much it is actually producing, what the value is, that's where you can work it. So price on understanding intrinsic versus extrinsic. Extrinsic, what will it sell for? Intrinsic is really diving down in deep and making sure you know what it's producing and what it can produce. Now, a broker comes to you and gives you financials. They give you, here's my pro forma, right, that I work up with. We'll talk about that in a second, everybody. But then they come and say the owner wants to sell this at $5 million. And you're like, well, that's a five cap in today's market. So the first thing you probably would do is say, I'm not paying a five cap. Interest rates are X level. It doesn't matter that he wants it. I can't afford it, right? Banks aren't going to underwrite it like this. And we're not going to do it. This isn't New York City. This isn't LA, right? This is any other market in the United States besides a first tier major market. Five cap's not, and a four cap's not going to do it. So we need to look at that. But the broker is trying to maximize the price of the owner. That's his job. Okay. So you need to come and say, where can I transact at it? Then you may look at it and say, listen, I've done my work. I can transact based upon this value that I'm getting at $4.5 million. Now you know where you're at. Now, you may not then offer $4.5 million. You may say, I'll start at four. But you may know that that's it. I can only do 4.5. And so then you and the broker start to work and work with the seller into finding out. Now, he may say, stuff it, go away. It's $5 million or nothing. Then you say, okay, goodbye, right? Now, when looking at this, it's important to explain to the broker. All right, I got to talk about this pro forma thing because the justification of price largely comes down to pro formas and everything. You need to remember that pro formas are made up numbers that are put into a spreadsheet. I would say not all brokers do this, but the vast majority of them that I've seen do. So we'll say 80% or more.
For sure.
They justify, they get the price of the owner, and then they make a pro forma to justify the price. What that means is the owner says, I want to sell this for $10 million. It's not worth $10 million. Then the broker says, okay, well, give me the numbers. And he's going to start looking at all the information, and he's going to put a bunch of stuff in a pro forma that shows how it could be worth $10 million. What that means is he made things up to get to a price. It's not like he did a pro forma, analyzed the market and everything, and said, this is only worth $8 million. That's what you have to sell it for. So he's creating something out of nothing to justify a price that somebody wants. This is incredibly dangerous. And they will look and sound amazing when they do it. And we've seen this way, way more in today's marketplace because brokers aren't able to move products. Why? Because the owners want too much and people can't afford them. Hmm. So all of a sudden we see things like 15% expense ratios. And we see things like 40% market rate increase when the markets, we had one that we were looking at. They literally said over the next 2 years, you're going to get a 25% increase in rates. That market had dropped by 20% in rates over the year prior. So they were saying that even though market rates and occupancy are dropping, your occupancy is going to go up and rates are going to go up by 20%.
Mm-hmm.
Even though all of those things were not happening, not only in that way, they were going the opposite. So I always ask, well, can we underwrite the other way? A 20% more drop in rates and occupancy following at the same rate that it has been. Well, we can't do that. Then where do you come up with your numbers? Mm-hmm. How does that exist? Because if we actually followed market performance, that's what would happen. So the problem being is what you look at is, well, if he comes up with those numbers, that's how he gets to a price, right? So this is something I obviously am very worried about, sensitive to, because we have seen this happen at mass today. Brokers, owners are like, I'm not selling for anything less than this because I can't. And brokers are justifying prices that are wrong and the value is not there and won't even transact at that value. What they're trying to do, and we've seen this because we've had brokers do this to us, I can get you X price. And the owner says, great. They go to market. They know they could never get this price ever. They go to market and then they come in with a lower one. Then they try to get the seller to sell at a lower one. So this happened to us. We had a broker that said, oh, I can get you, you know, whatever price. And we said, well, for these assets, it was a few assets. We said we would sell at $120 plus a square foot, but we would never consider selling anything less than that for any reason whatsoever, because we don't need to sell. Hmm. We don't even care. And the broker's like, okay, right. He came back with $98 a square foot, which we told him no. And then he was mad at us. Very mad. Why? Because he went through all this work and we're like,
so the 120.
I didn't ask you to. I never asked you to. I didn't ask you to take it to market.
Yeah, yeah.
I told you very clearly up front. But mm-hmm. this is the game that brokers are playing today. Then that's they play bad. It on the other side where they come and they just try to justify numbers, right? And the reason is they have to move product. They went from making money hand over fist the following 3 years. Over 65% of transactions just fell off the face of the earth, meaning the market contracted as far as contractions, or excuse me, as far as buying and selling went way, way, way down. So that created a huge problem. Now, that is why people get confused in today's market, because prices are all over the board, meaning that they're seeing five caps and they're going to go, I can't buy it at a five cap or that $1 million because I can't afford it. So we move on. They don't know, though, that it's not actually going to trade for. So I haven't seen one deal that went to the market at that price and actually sold at that price. It sold at something far below. So remember this, everybody, when you're getting things from brokers. These are your two methods: broker, off market. This is how you come up with prices. Okay. Mm-hmm. That's just step one in buying.
Yeah, so. No, a huge step. And honestly, so much of that's really important that you were just talking about with value and price, especially with the off market deals where you're just coordinating and talking to the owners, because they do have that situation where they have this expectation of, well, I either bought it at this price, so I should get that price back plus some, or I think it's just worth this much, so this is what I need to get for it. Like in that educational process that you have to go through to show one of those sellers what the actual, you know, real value is today of the asset, there's a lot to that.
Yeah, I mean, you're exactly right. And when you look at this price and offering too, I think people, you got to realize that to make a market, it's a volume game. All you're trying to do is figure out which one I can buy to get what I'm trying to get at. A lot of people think that they should go in and, oh, I couldn't buy it at that price. That means I can't buy something. And it's like, what? That was one asset, one seller, right? Mm-hmm. We look at so many deals because we're trying to find the right fit, and you should too. All right. So price is the first step. The second step is your actual contracts, which means that we've agreed upon a price. You have two contracts, LOI and PSA. An LOI is a non-binding letter that comes to an agreed upon structure that the PSA, purchase and sell agreement, will actually be built on. That's what you actually legal document to go and buy and go under contract. The LOI is important because it states, first of all, the main things, price and the main terms, meaning that here's my price, here's how we're going to close. That will decide things like how much you're putting down, and to go into due diligence, how long due diligence will be, who can get out of the contract for what reasons, what exceptions there are, what third-party reports you want. The LOI you'll design and say, this is how we're going to come together to buy this asset. Okay. The reason we do an LOI, if it's not the real agreement, is because you don't want an attorney making up a PSA on things you haven't agreed to, and then attorneys sit there and argue back and forth on how the PSA should be constructed.
Got
to
limit that.
Yeah. And then you're just racking up bills and wasting everybody's time, and
happens
you can never come
already.
To it. So an LOI you can make. We have examples of it. You can go, everybody in our group gets our LOIs. And then you use that LOI to say, here, I'm going to pay $1 million. We're going to close in 3 months. I have 1.5 months of, or the 3 months due diligence, but 1.5 before the money goes hard that I've put into, which is the money that you're putting in to go under contract. So let's say
earnest
it's
money.
$50,000. Yeah, your earnest money. So let's say it's $50,000 to go into contract. That means any time before that point, I can get out and just take my money. So if I'm doing due diligence and things aren't as I saw, oh, thanks, I'm out. My earnest money, I'm taking, we're gone. Now, after it goes hard, you can't, but there's other exceptions that you'll want to put in. You want to put in things like, all right, well, there's all these third-party reports you need to get, appraisals. You need to get a bank to give you the money, right? You need to do phase one studies, things like that. Anytime there's a third party that has to do it, that's always an exception, meaning that if a third party doesn't get it done in time, or if a third party comes back and something's wrong, I get my money out.
Yeah, we have a survey review period in ours where, it might be past that due diligence money, like 30-day time frame, 60, whatever. But if we haven't gotten a third-party survey report back, we still have, the 14 days or whatever it is that we have to review those things and to issue, our rebuttals or whatever we want to do.
Exactly. And the reason being is they're third parties. We can't control. It's like Connor's saying. Survey comes back and all of a sudden we find out the lines were completely wrong. Your facility is actually built on somebody else's land. And the owner's like, I don't care. I'm taking your $50,000 if you're walking away. And you're like, but this had nothing to do with us. Mm. You lied.
Yeah.
Right. That's why we have it, because third party reports, we can't control the time and we don't know what they're going to come back at. So we need to be able to get out. Outside that, once you move into that time, let's say the money goes hard, that means you're ready to buy it unless third party studies come back. Mm-hmm. Now you're moving on to, so first of all, LOI, PSA, that is step number two, price, contracts. Once you get into the contracts, the PSA outlines, we're going to use, our 3 month period of time, which we talked about the main things, third party studies, how you get out, price, what you're putting down, close conditions, what is allotted. Can I go onto the facility? That you also need to include in there. Your PSA will say, we need all information. We need everything else. Mm-hmm. During that leads to, as the PSA, that moves into going to actually close.
Are you a new self-storage investor and want to know what that facility is worth, what the risk is, how to underwrite it? Well, that's exactly what we do in a feasibility study. A feasibility study, we actually look at the market for you. We look at the finances, the underwriting, we show you where the upside is, the downside, and all the risk. That is actually what you can provide to banks to get capital and investors. It's a big worksheet, which most banks actually require. So if you want to know what a storage facility is worth that you're looking at, come to us, follow the link in the show notes, and we will tell you.
The due diligence period of time, that is right. The close, the due diligence time is broken up into two parts. Your money's step one is before the money's hard. Step two is after the money's hard. Step one, you need to get all of the documents. You're talking P&Ls, rent rolls, everything else to determine what is actually happening. You're checking all the information. You want to make sure you know inside and out how many units there are, what everybody's renting for. You want to go to the site. You want to look at how the condition of the site is. You want to understand what their software they're using. Are they marketing? You want to know everything about the operations, the condition, and the money. Those three things. Why? Because that will all be put into your model to show how much it's making and what you can pay. And you're verifying the numbers and assumptions that you made when you came up with the price. Very important period, because then you may walk away and say, yeah, we can't actually make nearly as much money. This is in bad condition. This isn't nearly as good as we thought. So we're walking away. Mm-hmm. Or you can come back and say, actually, there's more opportunity, or it's just what it thought. We're going to move on. And then you move on. Your money goes hard. Once your money goes hard, I view that as we're done. We're buying it. Outside third-party reports, we're buying this asset. We move in from there to step, we got price, contracts, first step. So price, contracts, first step in due diligence. And then the fourth step is money goes hard. This is, to me, basically closing. So at this point, we have like our whole team, right? So you're now in it. You're in it before, but now it's really in it. Why? Because now you and the team and our property management come on to say, we need to have everything ready by closing day to transfer this asset into our system. So you guys are now all on the ground. And why don't you explain a little by, all right, the money's hard. So we know outside third-party reports, we're buying it. What do we do then?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we're gathering, like you said, you're gathering all of that information from the seller and analyzing it. You mentioned rent rolls. You mentioned all the different pieces of the facility. So you need to know, like, are they currently taking security deposits? How many tenants do they have? What's the occupancy? Do they have, you know, the property management systems, like you mentioned? What's that transfer going to look like? What documents do we need to get in preparation for that transfer with our property management systems to be able to then just plug and play day one? Because, you know, on close, closing day, we want to essentially be able to go in and run that facility day one. We don't want to have any lag time, lag periods, any of that whatsoever. We want to go in, be able to flip a switch. Everything is on to our property management system and software. We have all of our merchant services set up. We have utilities in our name, the internet set up. Everything is good to go. So there's a lot of that just initial setup in, you know, the weeks leading up to closing where we're talking to the utility companies, the internet, we're getting all of that in line, talking to the property management system companies, getting login information from the seller if we can to be able to log in and look at a lot of the information on their property management system. And again, being able just to connect all the pieces possible before that actual onboarding of that facility and that asset. Another huge piece is the employment aspect, right? Like who's going to be running the facility, depending on how you're going to run it, right? If you're remote, whatever, you enjoy that. yeah, it's like if you need to hire people, if you need to fire people, if you need to, is somebody living there on site? What does that look like? And if you are going to have someone living there on site and manning the facility, can you also have another employee there on site? Or are you going to have a completely separate quarters or office for other employees because the current office is like the home of someone that's living there on site? So just a lot of those different aspects, again, through due diligence and leading up to close that you really have to be prepared for. Obviously, too, you know, being value add, we're looking at rates. We're always looking at the rates, seeing where they're at currently, what we're projecting that we can get the rates at. I don't know, maybe it's 20%. We'll find out increase.
Yeah exactly.
Those are great. But all said and done.
Yeah, we're underwriting constantly.
Yeah, exactly.
Like every single new thing that comes in, our due diligence, we have an actual, like we have a cloud-based system that we go on. We're inputting all this information. Nope, this door is broken. These rates are here. Here's the competition. That is all going into our cloud system. And back at the home office, the underwriters are going through and changing underwriting models with all of the inputs.
Yep.
So that due diligence period, even when you go into close, it is verifying those assumptions. Mm-hmm. And when you're moving into close, you're getting way more detailed like you're talking about.
Definitely. Well, and then too, you're talking all the maintenance stuff. You're setting up your ongoing preventative maintenance contracts, whether it's landscape or HVAC, mechanical, electrical, plumbing, any of that kind of stuff. And you're planning for those capital expenditure projects like you'd mentioned as well. Yeah, are you installing a gate? Are you doing a bunch of repairs because there's an aspect of the facility that's affecting the operations and your ability to, you know, collect, you know, revenue. So just a lot of those different aspects and making sure that day one, you've got a plan. Another huge takeaway over the past year or so for me especially has just been this dynamic of when we bring on a facility, there's been facilities that we've brought on that we never within the first, you know, 30 days got to like a maintainable standard. You know, there's been little things here and there that just never really got done or never really, like a standard wasn't set and secured in the first 30 days at that facility. So it's kind of just limped along for a while. So with all of our acquisitions, what we've done is implemented a plan to have essentially this goal and this plan of execution to actually get a facility to a maintainable standard, our standard, within 30 days. It could be, I mean, there might be some nuance, 60 days, depending on what the projects are, how heavy the lift is and all of that. But essentially, we don't want to hand over a property with all of these issues to a self-storage manager on site to try to figure out and fly by the seat of their pants and all this stuff. We're going to fail. We're going to set them up for failure. We want to be able to hand either a current employee that we adopted or a new employee that we hired. We want to be able to hand them a ready-to-go facility.
Yep.
Everything, the standard has been set. All they got to do is maintain it.
Yep.
So that's another big key to, like, set the facility up for success. Set yourself, your team, everybody up for success. Don't leave any stones unturned. Clear the slate. Get it all done. First 30, 60 days, clean house like crazy. Front load all of it. And be able to just, from that point, have a facility that's a maintainable standard from that point on.
100%. That's now, and that leads us into the next step, which is closing. Oh, sorry, forgot to mention the step after you obviously price contracts and then you move into due diligence, right? When you do that, you need to select a title company. Okay. So you need to select a title company, which will hold the earnest money, and they have the contracts and the PSAs going on. So once you move into closing, right, we have our closing, which we need the title company will work with to, and the bank. So the biggest part of when we start our step three, which is moving into due diligence, we're already working in tandem with banks. So the third party part is a big part in buying this facility. You have banks that will dictate third party reports. You have third party people that you need to deal with, which is things like your software, your landscaping, your snow plows, your contractors, everything that goes into that, your products that you're selling at the facility, your security systems, your gate monitoring, all those third party people come into saying, all right, here's how the business is being run. Here's what we need to do. And what are they doing? How much do they cost and how we will transfer over? The bank is a huge piece of this because they're the one giving you the loan. So during that time, the bank will also be requiring to take all this information in. A lot of due diligence is predicated on what the bank wants. So you're getting that, you're getting third parties that you need for operations or understand. You're also then getting third parties like appraisals done and you're getting things done like phase one studies, and you're trying, the bank wants to understand ALTA surveys, where the property is, where the property lines are, make sure what they're buying, they're actually getting. Those are dictated lots of times by the bank and what they want to see. So they'll request those and get those. This is all happening in each step. So the two steps that are broken up, we have an underpinning base during due diligence to close. And that is the financing piece. Now, other third parties, yes, but the other third parties, even though I include in the banking part, because the banking's going to dictate really the third parties that are absolutely necessary to close. You don't technically need a software or even a gate company to close. Now, life's going to suck if you don't.
Yeah.
Right?
It's going to be fun.
It's going to, yeah, you're going to be like managing, but you don't necessarily have to have that to go through the process of closing. Now, the bank is different, and the third parties that they require are different because you actually need that. That runs during this whole process along, and you've got to work in hand with them to get it done. Now, the money that goes down into it, you also need to have that ready and accumulated, whether that's investors, whether it doesn't matter, you got to have that ready. Then, once you move into closing, the bank, the title, and you will fund, and the bank will fund, all work hand in closing day, to fund the title company to do it for us, to get title over, to take over ownership, the owner to get the money, the bank to fund it, and everything else to happen. That's all closing day, right? So that step is a coordination of all the things you've been doing prior, making sure everybody's on board, working with the title company and the bank to make sure all of these things happen. Closing day is a big, big day. Now, technically, by that time, we're now at that step. Closing day means you bought it. We're not done with buying, though. I add one last step. So let's go through the steps, step by step. Price, contracts, due diligence, prior to money going hard, due diligence after money goes hard, closing day. Those are your five steps, right? Now, we've explained all five of those steps. The last step is transfer day. Once you bought it, you still have to take it upon yourself to own, operate, and manage, okay? So even though the transaction closed, it doesn't mean you necessarily own an operating functioning business until you actually take it over. So after closing day, why don't you tell a little bit about the onboarding the facility?
Yeah, no, a lot of that, like we were talking about with the onboarding, is going to be getting those gate systems set up, getting the property management system set up, making sure that all of that gets ported over, getting those merchant services in place, having those ready to go, making sure that all of those things are communicating, working, talking to each other, also sending out your announcements of new ownership. So letting tenants know, like, hey, yes, we're under new ownership, and it's a fantastic opportunity for you to express your the value that you guys can be able to deploy for your tenants and your customers, yep, and all that kind of stuff. So it's
payment
a really
processing.
Exactly.
Yeah, all, yep, that stuff.
Every piece of that business and how you're going to run it, the signage, the everything, making sure the facility is ready to go, operable, you're meeting contractors, you're coordinating with contractors, getting those contracts set up again for preventative maintenance, all of those things. You're signing a lot of those contracts because hopefully in that, you know, leading up to closing, you've already been coordinating a lot of those things,
yep,
and can just execute contracts, you know, day, yep, of onboarding. And so a lot of dynamics there. You're probably going to have some churn. Obviously, you're going to see some tenants moving out here and there, most likely, especially, yep, if you're doing value add, yep, and you're coming in and improving things. And obviously, that's to be expected, right?
Yeah.
So you are going to have some time where it's going to take a little bit of time to onboard, get off the ground, get employees trained. That's another aspect there is,
yep,
you know, if you are adopting someone, you might be able to go in and start doing some training prior to close, something like that, depending on your relationship with the seller and all of that. But a lot of times, like especially with what we do, we're not doing anything till like day of close. Like,
yes,
we're closing, then we're doing the onboarding. At that same time, we'll be training either a new employee or the existing employee that was there. We'll be doing all of our just on-site surveying as well. That will not only be the surveying done for that day, but will be the surveying that will be continuing forward and the process for surveying that property for anybody else that goes and surveys it from our team. So we set those things up, and then also getting all of the tickets set up. So our ticketing processing systems, making sure that every discrepancy of that facility is identified and input into our ticketing system and accounted for. It doesn't matter if it's the most minor dent, ding, scratch, any of that kind of stuff. It's documented and it's ticketed. Maybe we get to it, maybe we don't, but it's there. Like,
yes,
we know it, it's existing. There's no surprises anywhere ever. That's essentially, in a nutshell, a lot of what we look at on onboarding transfer, yep, day.
Big important things, payment processing, that you are actually getting payments in.
Phone
leases,
numbers.
Phone numbers,
yeah, that's a big
data,
one,
information. That you make sure that you know which leases are fully executed, which ones are not. If you need to update a lease, you got to send that out.
Mm-hmm.
But
updating office hours, like
office
Google
hours,
listings, all of
Google
that kind of
listings.
Stuff.
Oh, that's, yeah, a really important one. Online Google listings, everything,
yep,
that needs to be updated, transferred under your brand. Everything needs to be able to be moved over. That's a 30-day thing, but that is step six. And from there, you now own, meaning that I view it now full ownership. You own the methods and means to which run the asset. So the contracts are signed with vendors, tenants, everything else. Now you really own the, mm-hmm, facility, right?
Yeah.
So there's a lot within all six of these steps. I know somebody may be, well, you forgot about this. Of course, because every situation is different,
yeah,
right? And every asset, every market is different. There's a lot that goes under, but that is the nuts and bolts of it, everybody. That is the main thing. Don't be overwhelmed. Lots of times people are hearing it, they're overwhelmed. I'm telling you kind of everything that we could think of. You will have third-party people that will be guiding you through this. When we first bought facilities and we went through this, the broker, the banks, the title companies, they all held our hands.
Mm-hmm.
Like literally, it was like, tell us what to do.
Yeah.
So that is the process. Go back and listen to this over and over and over again. But those people that you work with will really dictate how that goes and make sure everything's, you got to work very close with them, hand in hand. And you, that way you can have a smooth execution. Something will always go wrong. It
for
always
sure
does. That's okay. But if you have the meat, the core, everything right, then you just move forward and you take over that facility. And then you can move to optimizing it, growing, mm-hmm, it, and making a great business out of it.
Absolutely. There's always, like you said, there's always going to be the nuance and there's always going to be those more granular aspects. Like this is super high level, you,
yes,
know, and until you actually get in it,
yeah,
and all the granular details of just ordering a single third party report and what's required of getting that thing done. Like there's so many steps to it, but it's all doable. And again,
oh, yeah,
that's what those people are there for. And whether it's a broker you're working with or a third-party surveyor or the bank, your lender, all of those guys, I mean, that's what they're there to do.
And two, I mean, you may even go, I don't know what the price should be and I don't know what the value is. That's why we have feasibility studies. In fact, the mm-hmm. bank's going to require you to get a third-party feasibility study done. Yeah. Like, we do that. So you can order that straight from us and mm-hmm. we underwrite it. We look at the market, we look at everything and give all that data back, which you're going to have to do and give it to the bank anyways, because they're going to require it. So even in that step one, you have somebody holding your hand. So if you guys are interested in that, by the way, just follow the link below and you can order one of our feasibility studies, which we do. You can give to the banks and have that all work for you. So there is help all along the way, but this should give you a really good idea of what all is going to go into it. Mm-hmm. Then you can kind of move forward in understanding, make a list, literally go through, take our steps, make lists of everything under the steps that need to be done, and then adapt it to the facility you're buying. Oh, well, there's this, so I guess I need to look at this thing. But you know the third parties, you have the hand, somebody will come help you do the feasibility study. You'll work with attorneys on the contracts. You will work with the title and you'll work with the bank when you go into your due diligence periods. You will then work with third parties that the bank requires up until closing. Closing day, the title, the bank, everything will help you with. Then onboarding, you're either doing it yourself or you have a third party management company, which will then also help you. But then the companies that are third parties, like your software company, everything else, they will help you onboard the assets too.
For sure.
Somebody all along the way, take our list, use our steps, and that will guide you and you'll know everything you need to know.
100%. Go yourself a facility, guys.
There we go. Thanks, everybody.
We'll see you.